Are you ready for the ECC update that came out last Thursday? I'm going to have a special interview segment with one of the American Heart Association physician authors of the 2015 ECC update to talk about the changes for emergency cardiac care. If that's what you're looking for, you found it right here on this week's episode of the MedicCast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the MediCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the PodMedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'd like to take a moment and thank all of you for checking out the program this week. We've got a great show for you. We'll be looking at what's going on with this week's special segment. I'm going to be chatting with Dr. Robert Newmar, one of the authors of the newly released Emergency Cardiovascular Care Updates from the American Heart Association. Now, what are the key changes that have come out in this update, and how can the recommendations affect you and your patients? We're going to find out about that and more coming up in just a sec. Before we get to that, though, I do want to make sure that you check out the links and additional information available for you, and you'll find all of that over at the MedicCast blog at mediccast.com/blog. There's a show notes link at the top of the page. You can click that link, and it'll take you right to the most recent episode, or you can scroll down and find other previous episodes as well. There's also a search box, so if you're looking for something in particular, check it out. We've covered a lot of things over the last 10 years, but take some time and make sure you follow up on the information you get on the show each week. Understand how it applies to your own EMS practice and protocols. If you want to get back in touch with me, maybe you have a question after checking out a show and you couldn't find it in the links, well, go ahead and email me. Shoot me an email to podmedic@mac.com. I love to hear from you, and I get back to all your questions, so send me ideas for future episodes, questions on the shows, interview suggestions, whatever the idea may be, I will get back to you. I respond back to all those emails that come in, so please keep them coming. Also, don't forget our mobile app. That's right, the MedicCast can be sent automatically to your mobile device or tablet. Just go ahead and check out the MedicCast app in your device's store. It's absolutely free. Let's go ahead and get on into the rest of the show with our segment on the Emergency Cardiovascular Care Update with Dr. Robert Newmar coming right up. Dr. Newmar, thanks for coming on the show. It's great to have you. This is an exciting time every 5 years when we get the new ECC update from the American Heart Association. And this year, not a lot of earth-shattering changes, but some things that are pretty important nonetheless because of a kind of a shift in focus between in-hospital and out-of-hospital arrests. So let's talk a little bit about the first thing that leapt to my mind when we looked at this, and that was the focus that they had on a community or system-wide approach to cardiac arrest care.
Sure, I would be happy to talk about that. And again, thank you for the opportunity to speak. The chain of survival, when you think about it, for cardiac arrest is really only as strong as the weakest link. And based on the available data that we have, we know that there is significant variability in outcomes across different systems of care. And that would suggest, at least, that optimizing the system of care can have an impact on the quality of care provided and the outcomes. And when you think about it, if we were able to implement what we know to be effective across the entire chain of survival, all the way from recognition through bystander response, CPR, and then even to post-arrest care, we have the greatest chance of optimizing outcomes. So one of the major focuses of the new guidelines is looking at how we can really think about implementation of best practices and what we know across the entire system in order to achieve that goal. And you know, some of the key pieces of that really are related to baseline monitoring of incidents of cardiac arrest, quality of care, and outcomes. And without measuring it, we'll never be able to figure out whether what we're doing is going to improve it or not. So it's just going to be ideal moving forward for each system to be able to collect data on their incidence, quality of care, and outcomes. And then when they look at their data, then they'll have the opportunity to find out, you know, what part of their system would benefit most from optimization. Perhaps that's the bystander CPR rate, perhaps it's providing discharge instructions, or maybe even it's the post-arrest care in the hospital. And, you know, having that local quality improvement system will allow those providers and people participating in that system to actually see for themselves the impact of the outcomes on the patients that they care for.
So another thing that left out, and I mentioned it briefly in the beginning, was the splitting of the chains of survival into two separate chains. So there's an in-hospital chain of survival, and there's an out-of-hospital or pre-hospital chain of survival. What was the reasoning that was used to cause these chains to be separated from each other and given their own lives independently?
Yeah, this is something that the Emergency Cardiovascular Care Committee, both the committee members themselves and the writing group, really thought hard about, of how we, as we start to think about optimizing our system of care as a primary focus, what are the similarities and differences between how cardiac arrest care is delivered in the in-hospital setting and the out-of-hospital setting? And we recognize that a lot of the ways we phrase the guidelines or the way the guidelines are presented don't really take into account what might be different about recognition and initiation of care in the inpatient setting versus the out-of-hospital setting. So we tried to address that issue for the providers that work in those different arenas to optimize the guidelines that we provide. And when you think about the in-hospital setting, you know, one of the key differences there really is the opportunity for surveillance and prevention of monitoring patients that could potentially go into cardiac arrest and even intervening before they arrest to prevent that from happening. And the other is a team dynamic on the in-hospital setting. It's a different providers coming from different backgrounds and training to provide that care. And then on the out-of-hospital side, there's so much importance put upon the bystander in order to actually be a key part of the healthcare system in terms of responding to the cardiac arrest, making the diagnosis, activating the EMS system, providing what we, you know, is some of the most important therapies, and then even things like having the dispatcher involved as well as the EMS provider. So the systems, when you think about them, are both very complex and very rapidly evolving care provided, but they have significant differences that we think in order to try to optimize those systems, we need to think about them in two separate strategies.
You know, in the last 5 years, so many things have developed in the realm of technology, and really we have come to a point in our lives where mobile devices have become so common that even younger children have them, entire families have their own mobile devices, and with that comes apps. And we've seen over the last few years several different apps produced to help alert potential responders, where you talked about bystanders and the importance of bystander response and CPR. So there was a mention, which I found interesting, of the use of mobile alerts, not specifically any given app, but some kind of mobile alert system might be appropriate. Would you like to talk a little bit about that? I know there was a study in Sweden, if I remember correctly, related to that.
Correct. And again, I just reemphasize the point that in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest especially, it really is, when we think about it, the most critically ill human condition that you could be in. And we rely on either untrained or minimally trained bystanders to make the diagnosis, make it rapidly, activate the EMS system, and initiate some of the most important therapy, early CPR and defibrillation. And, you know, we've had strategies in the past in terms of training large numbers of people to be able to respond, but with the advent of new technologies, we need to think more broadly about how we can optimize or empower the bystander to respond and create a culture of responders that are not only trained but also willing to act and then enabled to act by potentially embracing some of these systems where, you know, any bystander that's knowledgeable and willing to respond gets a notification and can potentially respond. Now, it's early times for that kind of work, and although there is that very nice study out of Sweden that did demonstrate that they were able to increase the bystander CPR rate in that system, you know, translating that to the U.S. system into our culture may have some different challenges, but there are significant opportunities there. And although we've yet to prove that strategy improves outcomes, I think that research is going to be coming forward And I think we, part of the guideline recommendation was just to encourage communities to explore that option.
Absolutely. So one of the things that I noticed was that not only do we have a lower range of compressions, which we've had for a while, of a rate of at least 100 compressions per minute for our rate of compression, but we've got an upper number now. What was the research saying about hitting that 120 and beyond number?
Sure. You think about any particular therapy that we do, there's the potential for it to be underdosed and overdosed, and that's one way to think about it. And when you think about the data that's available on cardiac arrest, compression rate is, at least for that range of 100 to 120, is the range in which is associated with the best outcomes. So that was the underlying data to support that. Underlying that in terms of a mechanism, there's really the possibility that when you get in a rate that's too low, obviously you may not be getting enough forward blood flow because you don't pump the heart as fast as you potentially could to move blood forward. On the higher end, there's a couple of potential mechanisms by which you could have decreased the efficacy of CPR. One is that there's not enough time in between compressions for the heart to refill, so there's not as much blood to pump out with each compression. And also there's some data that at higher rates, it's harder to get a good compression depth. So if you get to a too high a rate, your people providing the CPR may not be doing the most optimum depth, and that's a potential interaction between the rate and the depth. So again, this is a range for optimal compressions. When you think about, it's one of the easier metrics within CPR quality to measure, whether you have a metronome, and I'm sure you're familiar with some of the songs that are being put forward that have a sort of a meter or beat per minute around 100 that you can remember to help people do compressions in that rate. But we have more and more modern devices for CPR quality that allow people to keep their compressions in that range.
Now, there's, like you mentioned, there's also a depth, maximum depth recommendation now, where it was at least 2 inches in depth of compression. Now we're saying 2 to 2.4 inches. For manual compressions, that seems rather difficult to gauge, although I did notice that there was a statement that, for the most part, compressions tended to be too shallow rather than too deep. But for vigorous firefighters and new EMTs that just want to show how good they are, we need to caution them not to be compressing too deeply, too forcefully into the chest.
Yeah, and that's correct. And again, this is again an example of, as we do more research in cardiac arrest, we get a little bit more refined based on the available data and what we put into the recommendations. And I totally recognize that if you're standing there over the chest of somebody, being able to self-titrate your compressions between 2.4 inches is very challenging. Even if someone looking at you from the side is going to be a challenging thing. A lot of that is designed for the feedback devices that will dial in a certain feedback based on your compression depth and allow that to give some feedback if the compressions are too deep. So that's sort of the practical implications of that. But on the mechanistic side, the data would suggest that a compression rate that's too deep doesn't necessarily generate any additional blood flow. There's sort of a ceiling on that, on how much blood flow. Once the heart's empty, it's empty, for example. But then pushing harder or with a greater depth might increase the risk of complications such as rib fractures.
Okay. And there's, the thing I thought of instantly when I thought about the depth was this something that was looking at the possibility of being more in favor of the mechanical devices that are out there, but that's not the case.
I think it also does have implications for the mechanical devices because they specifically dial in a set depth, and most of them are set at a specific depth, not a range, so it doesn't affect them too much. But it really probably is more where it's practically implemented is in the feedback devices.
Okay. All right. So we looked at the healthcare provider CPR, and there were several things that I think shifted away from the concept of this methodical approach to assessment early in the process to a more streamlined multitasking approach. Was this just a clarification of the previous statements in the 2010 guidelines that they wanted to push forward?
Yeah, I think some of it's a little bit of a clarification. Some of it's just sort of trying to recognize how people are going to be potentially responding to arrest. For example, the mentioning of a mobile phone device for an activation versus sort of in the old days we'd have to have someone go to a telephone or call out for help. So sort of one of it's incorporating new technology and how you might activate the system with, almost everyone has a cell phone, and that might be the best way to do it in most cases. But also, yeah, that teamwork approach, especially in a healthcare provider situation where there's two or three people in the room, it certainly doesn't make sense to have the other two people standing around while someone goes through all the steps of recognition and activation, and that sort of teamwork or pit crew approach is what that we're trying to emphasize.
So as one of the authors in the guidelines, one of the people on the committee that's been looking at all the research and everything that's coming in, is there a thought that you'd like to leave with our audience of nurses and students and paramedics out there that you would like to share with them about the guidelines, something that just is something you find very important?
Sure. I think that the most important thing that we recognize as we go through the literature, and there's more and more clinical research than ever before in cardiac arrest resuscitation, but there's still many, many more questions that haven't been answered. But one of the things that I think every healthcare provider has the potential to have an important impact on cardiac arrest survival, and if we really want to move the needle in outcomes, the key that we're trying to emphasize, especially with this round of guidelines, is that optimizing that system of care for both out-of-hospital cardiac arrest and in-hospital cardiac arrest is going to be essential. Monitoring, and the key to that is monitoring and improving the performance. So any healthcare professional, wherever they work, in an EMS system or in a hospital, has the potential to be a local champion for quality improvement, and that's advocating for data collection, data monitoring, and reporting of incidents, reporting of quality of resuscitation, and reporting of outcomes in their system. And then, being part of a team that looks at that data, finds the weakest link in the chain of survival or the best opportunity to improve outcomes, and then do quality improvement measures to measurably change the quality of care. And then what you'll be rewarded by is you'll be able to see the improved outcomes of the patients that you treat in your system.
Excellent. Well, doctor, I want to thank you very much for taking some time. This is, again, I think one of the more exciting times in emergency care. I look forward to every 5 years. I guess that makes me some kind of a medical nerd, but it's a good time of to be in the healthcare business.
Yeah, no, it is an exciting time. And again, the other impact of the guidelines is to get people focused on this is an important issue in terms of an important healthcare issue, both inside the hospital and outside the hospital. The recent Institute of Medicine report that came out over the summer really highlighted the burden of cardiac arrest as a disease in our system and the need that we have to optimize our systems of care and improving outcomes. And there's still a lot of work to do, but there's great opportunities for people to get involved.
That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show this week, and of course, remind you to follow up on all of the information you get in this week's show over at the MedicCast blog. That's at medicast.com/blog. Over there, you'll find a show notes link at the top of the page. Go ahead and take a moment and follow up on all of the information and links to news items and more you find there each week. You can also sign up for our email newsletter that'll bring you those links directly into your email inbox each week if you want. There's a form on the right-hand side of the page. Just go ahead and fill that out, and you can get the MedicCast newsletter for yourself. I also welcome your comments and suggestions by email. So if you want to get back in touch with me, shoot me an email to podmedic@mac.com. Send in your ideas for news links, ideas for future show topics or interviews, whatever comments you might have. I really do look forward to hearing from you, and I'll make sure I get back to you. I work hard to respond back to every email that comes in, so please keep those emails coming. If you want to catch up with me on social media and some of the pages and sites out there, you can find me at most places under the handle PodMedic. So you can catch me over at Twitter at twitter.com/podmedic or Facebook at facebook.com/podmedic. Friend or follow me over there. Also, don't forget to check out our MedicCast Facebook page. We now have over 5,000 followers, so head over to facebook.com/medicCast. Click the like button on the top of the page and join the community over there. That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. Please make sure you spread the word and share the MedicCast with your colleagues and students and friends in the EMS world. I'll be back here each week with new episodes, new interviews, news items, tips, and more every Monday morning to start off your EMS week. Tell somebody else about the MedicCast today. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. It's time to close out the show. Don't forget to thank our sponsors, and remember, folks, Scene Safety, BSI.